This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
To me, the final decision to not have a production cut at the OPEC meeting and watch prices fall is a brilliancy. It's a masterstroke.
Last week, I spoke with energy analyst Dan Dicker about the reasons behind the sudden drop in oil prices and the potential impact this could have on energy markets and on the geopolitical landscape. This week on Sea Change Radio, you'll hear the second half of our discussion. Dicker projects the foreseeable consequences that falling oil prices will have on the renewable energy industry, discusses how the Russian economy is being affected, and provides some reasons that Saudi Arabia chose not to cut oil production. He also offers his unique perspective on what he views to be missteps or at least missed opportunities within the environmental movement. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by energy analyst Dan Dicker. Dan, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thanks for having me, Alex. Sure.
Now, first for our listeners, Dan, can you recap the rapid shift that's occurred over the past several months in terms of oil prices?
Prices stabilized at around $100 a barrel and had been, rotating between about $90 a barrel and $110, depending on geopolitical dust-ups, civil war in Libya, various other Arab Spring revolution-type things that sort of put supply in doubt, and this summer saw a number of those geopolitical dust-ups, but instead of seeing prices go up, saw them retreat, and that should have been a telltale sign that something was amiss inside the marketplace. Since then, it's been almost a straight shot down from July to when we were about $103, $104 a barrel to where we are now, which is, it actually touched close to $55 a barrel before recovering over the course of the last couple of days, still below $60 a barrel.
Last time we saw a real drop in global oil prices, or a significant one that folks like myself knew about, was in the 80s. And that really set the renewable industry back, some say several decades. It didn't have the scale at that point to recover from that cheap oil. So what we're seeing from the renewable industry is at least messaging to the street, to analysts, that they definitely are not impacted by these dropping prices, that they have enough scale and enough stability right now to be able to deliver, and then these fossil fuel prices are not affecting their business and not really eating into any kind of competitive advantage they had in higher oil price markets. Do you agree with that?
No, unfortunately, I do not. I do not at all.
You think this is going to really hurt the renewable industry?
Absolutely, and I, you know, I'm always, you know, I'm always met with really dirty looks. I think perhaps the only true oil person analyst on the planet who is a renewable advocate. I would so much like to see this world move from fossil fuels into renewables. One of the things that we need, and one of the things that's entirely unrecognized as something that we need to move into renewables, is a tremendously high price for fossil fuels. I mean, that's just the way it is. Whether that's done artificially through price controls or carbon taxes, whatever. Artificial way you want to pump up prices, or if it's just naturally done because the costs of getting fossil fuel continue to increase and demand, in fact, continues to increase. This cannot be, this move down in oil could not be worse in any way for the renewable fuel industry. Just look at the increase in the demand for big, fat, nasty trucks burning diesel fuel over the past 2 months. It's been monumental. I think truck sales are up 80%. This is not a clarion call for solar energy. this is a happy day for those who want to burn cheap gasoline to their heart's content for as long as they possibly can. And you can see it in both the initiatives that have been coming out of Washington for alternatives, as well as the stocks. The prices of the stocks in the solar industry and other renewables have been absolutely as badly hurt as the oil companies here. And that's a function of economics. You know, most of the renewables without very serious government incentives are expensive. They're even with incentives, they're generally more expensive than fossil fuels. And with cheap fossil fuels around, there's very, very little reason to push hard, economically speaking, for renewables. There's lots of great moral reasons, but you know, when you really want to move large numbers of people, use the dollar, use money. It's the quickest way, and it's the way that I see for a clear renewable future. And it starts with a very, and I mean a very high price for oil. As much as environmentalists and environmental advocates would hate to see it, or it would hurt them to see, you want Exxon making not $200 billion a year. You want them making $500 billion a year, because that means that you finally have an economically viable, renewable source of energy that you can push at somebody and say, hey, not only does this help the planet, but it's at least as cheap as the stuff you're burning in your car, and maybe cheaper.
How long do we need these prices to be at this level for this to affect renewables negatively? Are we talking 6 months, 5 years?
Yeah, I think it puts very much on hold the required incentives that are needed to move large numbers away from fossil fuels. And, you know, that clearly, we've run into a couple of serious roadblocks on that. And there's the two of them that give me pause or make me less optimistic right now is clearly a Republican-controlled Congress and this drop in oil prices. You know, I see those as two absolute roadblocks to moving forward on renewables on a national or a global level. And, you know, obviously I think that's a shame, but you know, I really don't know what to suggest.
Well, some of the people who say that this is different from the 80s price drop in the way it may affect renewables are pointing towards how solar, for example, stacks up against diesel-produced electricity now. I saw quotes from, granted he's a solar executive, but Tom Werner, who's the CEO of SunPower, which is owned by French oil giant Total.
Right.
And then also I saw a quote from a research analyst at Raymond James Financial saying the impact from lower oil prices is zero in North America and Europe as far as solar and wind go, where prices do not have any link to oil. This guy thinks.
You know, I hate to say this, Alex, but I think that's hopeful. That's wishful thinking. I really do.
No, I'm glad to get your perspective on it. And I think people need to have a clear-eyed view of this. And are we just talking about renewables as a part of the electricity grid? Does this also include home solar rollouts, in your opinion?
Yeah, I think it does. And part of what's you know, we've made some nice strides in home solar over the course of the last couple of years. And that's been in spite of a fairly, or at least a relatively low price for natural gas, which has really been the chief competitor on the grids for electricity. Again, what I'd like to see to make home solar much more viable is a natural gas price, not at, you know, $3.50 an MCF, but at least double that. And we've had it before. It's been, again, the lack of discipline inside the oil and gas industry that has overfished the waters of gas, fracking from gas, particularly in Pennsylvania and West Virginia and elsewhere, and has cratered a price of natural gas. Again, the greatest crime in that, to me, has been taking a national resource that should have belonged to all of us, that could have powered, you know, this country for 100 years, and helped us in a very, very controlled way move from fossil fuels to renewables, that will now last 40, and will again put us at the whim of other energy suppliers when that is tapped out, and it'll be a heck of a lot sooner than it would have been if at least a little discipline could have been imposed upon the industry from people and from government.
I'm glad to change my way of living. This life I'm living ain't no good. To change my way of living. This life I'm living ain't no good.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to energy analyst Dan Dicker. Getting back to your theory about we need the Exxons of the world to have even bigger balance sheets because of the higher oil prices. We need them to be able to point to that and say, see, there's a real problem. But do you think that this could be good because they could lead into a business model beyond oil where they're starting to make real long-term investments in renewables? Or do you think that, why don't you spell out why you think a larger, more profitable company like Exxon could actually help the renewable industry? I want to understand that more.
Yeah, and I think that's exactly right. I think you just said it perfectly. I mean, there's been lots of projects inside the majors on renewable energy. And as far as Exxon is concerned, they don't really care what kind of energy the world buys, as long as it's from them.
Right.
Make a lot of money from it. And they have abandoned, to a large degree, many of their renewable projects for very simple reasons. It's just, I can sell you oil cheaper than I can sell you, you know, fuel from switchgrass. And it's just as simple as that. And when it becomes economically viable and they see a long-term trajectory where I can sell you fuel from switchgrass at a cheaper price and make better profits off of that, as opposed to pulling it, you know, from 6.5 miles out of some body of water.
Without having to worry about environmental disasters.
Right. Or at least having my environmental disasters greatly reduced in terms of the risk there. Mm-hmm. They will jump into it, you know, with both feet. And again, they've gone through several projects expecting, you know, that future to materialize, and it hasn't yet. I mean, there was a time when even, you know, the oil companies, despite what they said, believed in peak oil. They don't anymore. And for good reason, they don't anymore. But, you know, now is they are non-denominational when it comes to energy dollars. They'll take it from wherever it comes. Some of the things that I don't rail against, but I sort of cringe at, is I go on a lot of MSNBC shows with a lot of environmental activists, and, you know, and the 360.orgs and that type, and I'm almost, you know, you're using two fists to beat against a 25-foot high 6-inch wall. It's the wrong way to try and move this mountain. It's unmovable. They're huge. The major oil companies in this country are massive, unresponsive, will swat you away like a fly. There's very little. When I look at the projects that the environmentalists have taken on over the last several years and the results of it, they're so small in the progress that they've made, I always think, you know, there's another way to go at this. There's, you know, just trying to trying to get colleges to leave, Exxon out of their endowments is, it's ridiculous. Or fighting like mad. I mean, I do understand the idea behind it, but fighting like mad to have one lousy pipeline not built. I mean, it's useless. It's sitting on White House lawns and, and telling the president, don't sign that bill. So don't sign it.
Assuming that you're on the same page with the environmental movement in terms of the long-term play, we all want to get to the same place. If you were the head of 350.org instead of Bill McKibben, who I gather is stepping down soon, hey, maybe there's a new gig for you. If you were running an environmental nonprofit, where would you devote your energy and resources, Dan?
I don't want to use that one. I love Professor McKibben. He's brilliant. I think he's great. I really adore him. What he's done has been incredible. But what I would say is that you need to fight for national standards so that it's much more expensive to get fuel out of the ground. And make sure that drilling is done up to a unified standard, as opposed to a state standard, which is difficult, if not impossible, to control. There has to be an energy policy in place that does not allow the haphazard kind of removal of resources at any speed that any capitalist decides is good. You need to have an increased movement towards natural gas. You have to embrace natural gas as a transition fuel from where we are to where we've got to go. Not only because it's greener, but it's cheaper, and it is the next stage of moving from a carbon eating planet to one that's less carbon eating. There are so many stages of taking, for example, crude oil and turning it into a filthy diesel, or taking tar sands out of the ground and then processing them to turn them into something you can burn in a heater or a car. And to me, you move in stages. You don't push for, the whole world to turn solar, because it won't happen. You push for an industry to move away from the filthier fuels into the ones that are less filthy first, and you devote your energies there. And from there, making those as cost effective as you can, so that you can finally push forward on a renewable future that makes sense against a fuel like natural gas. I think we would have done a heck of a lot better as environmentalists if we had supported natural gas bills like the Pickens Plan in Washington to move us away from being a crude-based economy to one that was natural gas-based. I think that the ban of fracking in New York is in many ways a loss for that movement. And it sounds counterintuitive.
No, I saw that they actually get like 80% of New York's power comes from natural gas. So I guess it's coming from neighboring states.
Yeah, it's coming from neighboring states. I mean, these are hailed as major achievements for the environmental movement. And I in some ways, and this is the hardest thing to believe, if you really want to get to a green future, you got to go through Exxon and not around them. And that's, I think, the key point that's been lost, for good reason, because they're vilified, and they're vilified for good reason too. So it's very hard to convince people to try and find something that comprehensively includes the major oil companies in our future. It's also difficult to sell, but you asked me, so I told you.
I'm the host of this show, so I like to have lots of different perspectives, and we don't have climate change deniers on this show, so we're not having that debate. But I think there's a lot of room for debate within what are the best methods to try to get to a cleaner planet. And then obviously you want the same thing that a Bill McKibben does, but your methods might be different.
Alex, I'd say I'm frightened to death about the future for my kids, and particularly my kids' kids, tell you the truth. And that comes from knowing, probably better than anybody else, how the oil and gas industry works.
There must be some way out of here, said the joker to the thief. There's too much confusion, and I can't get no relief. Businessmen, they drink my wine. Plowmen dig my earth, but none of them along the line know what any of this is worth. They just don't know what it's worth.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/SeaChangeRadio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to energy analyst Dan Dicker. So Dan, right when we started hearing the first flood of prices dropping, the fingers were being pointed to the Saudis trying to solidify OPEC and maybe as a shot across the bow to North America oil and gas exploration. But since that initial analysis has come out, Russia's economy has gone into a spiral, the ruble's plummeting. Do you think that there may have been something to the Saudis trying to affect Russia just as much as they were the U.S.? How does this plummet in oil prices, how has it affected Russia, and where do you see it moving forward?
Yeah, well, Russia is clearly a petrostate and very much dependent upon oil revenues to very much to the degree that an Iran or a Saudi Arabia is, and it is in the level of services that they provide their people that makes it so much more difficult for the Russians. Now they do other things besides oil, but again, such a large degree of their revenue is a consequence of oil sales.
And so Norway and Russia just attend OPEC meetings. They're not members of OPEC, correct?
That's correct. And in fact, I mentioned earlier in the broadcast how the Saudis had in fact visited the Russians. That was before the meeting of OPEC members in Vienna in November. And ostensibly that was to ask for some cooperation in a production cut leading into the meeting. They did not get that cooperation. So in many ways, I think the Russians, you know, reap what they sow. Mr. Putin is nothing if not arrogant and believes he can withstand anything, even the market moves like this in oil. We'll see. I think he's certainly under more pressure. I don't think he's at any risk whatsoever of being overthrown or some other leader coming into Russia, because he does rule with an iron fist, not only among inside the Kremlin, but with the oil oligarchs who run the state-run organizations, the oil companies over there, who were appointed, in fact, or given free rein by Putin. Those who did not agree with Putin policies ended up like Khodorkovsky, sitting in a cage somewhere for 10 years in a Russian prison. So the oil oligarchs will allow Mr. Putin to conduct foreign policy any way he sees fit, because a complaint, is something that Mr. Putin has shown he doesn't tolerate all that well.
So do you think the Saudis didn't cut production to in some way undermine the Russian economy?
I'm not sure. I didn't see the Russians as top of the Saudi radar. I did see the Iranians at the top, and to a certain degree, I did see the Americans.
So if you can just recap the reasons you think that Saudi Arabia chose not to cut its production levels within OPEC.
Number one, I think they were willing to see a production cut, but couldn't get no consensus either inside or outside. And they wanted the cartel and everybody outside the cartel wanted it to be unilateral. They were unwilling to do that. And number two, I thought that they're not unhappy seeing the Iranians lose some influence. They're not unhappy, in fact, teaching the United States State Department a lesson on maybe they should listen to their allies in the Middle East when some of these issues come up, and they specifically warn them or ask them not to pursue certain foreign policy events. And I think that they're looking to, in fact, over the long haul, regain the relevance to the cartel that has been lost with the increase in production, mostly from shale plays here in the United States. That takes some time. They're going to see lower oil prices for a short period of time, maybe a year, and it will just cull out the weakies in the United States. And again, when that supply is off market, they can again assert themselves as the swing barrels, or the important swing barrels in the global marketplace. So for all these reasons, you know, to me, the final decision to not have a production cut at the OPEC meeting and watch prices fall is a brilliancy. It's a masterstroke.
So is it fair to say that they wanted to not only solidify OPEC's footprint in the global market, but also bolster their own position within OPEC as well at the same time?
Well, the Saudi position has always been secure inside OPEC. I mean, basically what they say goes, and that's the way it's been for a very long time. The Iranians are not happy about that, but that's the way it is. So they have always had control over the cartel. But I do not buy the theory that is among many of the oil analysts that this marks the end of the cartel as a viable organization. I think it is only a short vacation, and when the cartel comes back after production falls in the various places in the United States, Canada, Brazil, elsewhere, they will reassert themselves and the cartel will be stronger than ever.
Well, it's a fascinating discussion, and I appreciate you taking the time to share your insights with our listeners. I hope you come back on the show sometime soon. Energy analyst Dan Dicker, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you, Alex.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by Leon Mitchison, Howlin' Wolf, and the Brothers and Sisters.
Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.